Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Good evening. It is 8 o'clock. It is Thursday evening. This is LA Talk Radio, and you're listening to The Writer's Block. My name is Jim Christina, your host for the evening, in the studio with the ever-delicious Mr. Russ Avison.
Oh, tonight I'm delicious.
Oh, you are.
I love that.
Well, you know, we run out of adjectives for you, so...
Well, you know, in the very beginning, they say, you know, with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, and
I'm thinking, okay...
Well,
but it's ever charming and delightfully delicious, Bobby Bell.
There you go.
Okay. We have a great guest tonight, and we're going to get to her in just a moment. I'd like to remind you that the Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing in Simi Valley, by Out West Boutique and Cultural Center in Newhall, and by Target Freight Management in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And, you know, we mention Target Freight every show, and we mentioned that they have a full truckload service. That's the best in the industry. But have we ever mentioned that TFM Truckload is the finest in the industry and gets your freight there every time, on time, at the rates you need for your transportation costs? If we haven't, we probably should have. So call today at 844-653-7789. And as Bobby says, get a pencil, write this down. 844-653-7789 and tell them you heard it here on the Writer's Block. They'll have a little something extra for you. And while we're at it, if you are an LTL shipper, which is less than truckload, you are probably looking for the best rates with the least hassle. Call Target Freight Management today. Their customized transportation management system is just a ticket to getting your freight moved your way. Call Target Freight Management today at 888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com on the web. Call today. You won't be sorry you did.
Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
Before we move on? LTL, less than truckload.
Less than truckload.
How much is that?
It can be one pallet. It can be six pallets.
Oh, okay. So one pallet, you'd call these guys.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you have a truckload, then you call their truckload division.
All right.
Very simple. And they're really great
people. A truckload of pallets.
A truckload. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I deal with them every day. They're really, really, really good folks.
Okay.
Russ is with us, of course, on the fourth Thursday of every month because Bobby Jean and Out West have a concert series, which is going on this evening. And I Bobby Jean, I'm sorry, I forgot who's on tonight. My bad. But we wish you all the best. And we have our guest sitting here staring at me. And I have to tell you, this woman is phenomenal. She is like, she's done everything at least once. At least once.
Don't tell her husband that, though.
She's taught at USC. She's taught at UCLA. She's a writer. She writes everything from mystery to young adult to historical, Western, biblical, romance, true crime, thriller, romantic comedies, paranormal. Did I leave anything else out?
Nah. Not fiction, too.
She's a nurse. She's like everything in the world. Will you welcome, please, to the Writer's Block, Sarita Stevens?
Hey.
Here, let me give you a little clap here.
Okay.
Okay. I have to say right off the bat that Russ and I both read your book Against Her Will. Oh, my God. What a great story. I did. And I understand that came from your term as a psychiatric nurse.
Right. Exactly.
Which is really sad that it actually comes from true life stories.
It is. Yeah. Very sad.
And I assume that you were a psychiatric nurse in a young people's facility.
Mm-hmm.
Can we ask the name of the facility?
I don't think it's a good idea.
Okay, but...
Things have changed a lot since then, too.
I'm absolutely certain of that. But the characters in this book were so real. They just were so real, and you just... I mean, you sympathize with some, you empathize with some, you just downright hated some.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the one you downright hate so much, she turns out to be okay, and the other one you didn't like so much anymore. So I just kind of, it was a merry-go-round of people coming
in
and out. Yeah.
Yeah.
So my first question then is going to be, these characters, were they compilations of people that you actually knew, or are they actually based on individuals?
Yes, they were compilations of people I knew. And I also have to thank my writing partner, this Joe Schaefer, who helped me mold the story a little bit better, too. I had actually written the original story and outline almost 15 years ago, And I tried selling it, and nobody was buying it. And suddenly my agent asked me, well, do you have anything young adult? Well, I do. I sent her the first half a book that I had written and never done anything with. She says, I've got a great person for you to team up with. And so Joe and I finished the book together, and it's against her will.
Excellent. They originally asked you, do you have anything for young adults?
Right.
And as I was reading it, I thought, this is really an interesting perspective, because being an older adult and looking back, you don't remember all of these feelings and trials and tribulations that you go through and what was important to them at the time. And it's very interesting how they go through and sort out their situations, and they don't get really, you know, it's almost like you're working with half brains. I mean, and I don't mean that but I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but they don't have the ability to process what everything means. They're almost reactionary and everything.
Yes. Well, I got a lot of the information on that current stuff from my own daughter, who helped me with the temper tantrums and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. When they hit 13, they just know everything. It's just like...
Don't they ever. She still thinks she knows everything, and she's 21.
Well, mine, fortunately, is... How old is Margaret Megan? 35?
She's probably 37? Out there.
37?
No, she's not that
36.
Old. 36.
She's 36.
Yeah, but she looks like she's 28.
Yeah. Russ knows my daughter real well, because they're both dog trainers. She's in the East Coast, and Russ is, of course, out here. You know, I found myself when I was reading your book, because your protagonist, I guess you could call her protagonist, the main character.
Cassidy.
Protagonist is somebody who happens most of the action.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily mean good by bad by.
Right. But she kept coming up with her parents hated her, and nobody would listen to her.
Right.
And you go within yourself and you think, holy crap, now I'm in my 60s. Did I treat my kids like that?
Oh, probably. I treated my
I had to dig deep on that one. I don't think I ever did. But maybe, I mean, you don't know. You don't remember. You know, because they turn out okay, and, you know, then they hit 30 and they're your best friend. And, you know, it's no longer a big deal. But I wondered.
I don't know. I have no kids to base it on.
So. I know the bookie didn't.
No?
No. No. Huh. The bookie is Jerry. She's my wife. She's the one that booked you and my editor and my boss at Black Dog. So.
All right. So I want to ask you then, let's talk a little bit about the Cassidy protagonist.
Okay.
And as you mentioned a little earlier that things have changed a lot as far as how the hospitals work versus what was going on in this book. What is the time frame that this was set approximately?
The original book was, I started it back like in the 1970s. When I was first starting to dabble with writing. My first book actually wasn't published until 1983. Mm-hmm. And I had written 8 books before my 7th one got published. My 8th one got published.
Okay.
And I was able later to go back and revise 4 of those 7, because I'd go back and say, oh my God, did I write like that? It was horrible. You know, and I realized, you know, with each and every book, each and every script I write, I make it better and better.
Sure.
And in fact, I constantly take classes, even despite the fact that I've done so much, because you can learn from everyone.
Yeah, that goes along with dog training too. The same, you know, my career is that we're always out there and finding and learning from other trainers and other behaviorists, because anybody who says, well, I know all that, that's the person you want to know.
That is true, actually, because I find myself learning a lot from the different writers that have been in here in the studio with us and that we have called and had spent an evening with. And I find myself picking up little tidbits here and there. So it does. Osmosis does work.
Even when I'm teaching, I'll say, we have to do this and this for your character. And I'll say, oh, gee, I haven't done that for my character this time. And I'll go back and revise it. You know, sometimes you get so caught up in your writing that you forget what you're supposed to be doing.
I found myself doing that today. And then I sent an email to one of my good friends. His name is Dale Jackson. He writes as D.B. Jackson. And he's just a tremendous author. But he killed a dog in his second book. I sent him the email. I said, Dale, I have done everything. I've killed horses, men, rattlesnakes, rats. Bulls, buffalo, but I've never killed a dog.
Yeah.
Actually, one of my books had a cat in it, and this was a historical about the Filet de Roy, the daughters of the king, and the girl runs, her cat Alexander, who's my cat was Alexander, is murdered, and I run out to my neighbors and I said, Alex is dead! What happened to Alex? I said, oh, it's you're writing about it. Oh, my God. You know, really.
Yeah, that's funny you mentioned, because in this book, Cassidy has a cat.
Right.
And when she, the first incident that occurs where she gets separated from her cat.
Right.
And all along, I'm wondering, well, bring the cat back. What happened to the cat? What happened to the cat? And thankfully, you did bring that in later
of
on.
Of course.
But I, that was at the forefront of my mind during a lot of the reading.
Well, because that was the only thing that actually loved her.
Yes.
Right. Oh, so she thought. I mean, her parents really did love her. They just didn't know how to deal
they
with
didn't
her.
Know, yeah.
Well, and that comes around to the way this was handled, because as you either as you're reading it, either you empathize with Cassidy or you don't. But as I was trying to be, you know, more objective and stand back and see what was going on. But my feeling was through all of this that her experience being in that hospital was probably the worst thing that could have ever happened to her. There were so many things that would never have occurred. I don't want to give any story
away.
Yeah. But there's a lot of things that occurred that never would have happened had she not been in the hospital. She definitely needed help. She
yes.
definitely did help.
Oh, yeah.
But this was the wrong place, I think.
It probably was. And she learned in the end that nothing was against her will.
True.
That she could control her own life.
Right, right. And that's one of the major points in the book, is that you finally get to that point near the end, is that she actually had control of everything that happened to her.
Right.
She just opted not to take control.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I got that part. I'm pretty smart.
So, yeah. Something that I remember learning a long time ago, and somebody told me, and they said that wherever you are in your life, you are a product and in a place as a result of all the decisions you've made up to
Absolutely.
This point. And so if you had changed your decisions, you would change where you are.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's
Absolutely.
Deep.
Yeah.
It was, yeah.
But I've kind of like looked at that. So I think it helps me not try and put blame on other people for any misfortunes I may have.
I think anybody who's successful in life kind of subscribes to that one way or another.
Yeah. Maybe.
Well, it's like, I don't know that I'd be my person now if I wasn't my person then.
Right.
I wouldn't have come out to California if I hadn't done what I did in Chicago. But, you know, I did, and I learned from it.
There you go.
By the way, where did you live in Chicago?
West Rogers Park, Evanston, Skokie.
Skokie.
Yeah, Skokie.
That's where I'm from, yeah.
Yeah.
I was born in Chicago, lived in Skokie, and I had relatives, Donner's Grove,
yeah.
and Batavia, St.
Mathis
Charles.
High School, University of Illinois Med Center, Chicago Circle.
Gotcha.
Then he became a Valley boy.
Yeah.
I did.
Okay.
Gagged me with a spoon. I want to bring up this. I walked in and your husband handed me this book, and it's The Ultimate Writer's Workbook.
Right.
And you're definitely going to sign this before we leave here tonight, incidentally. You go by Sarita Stevens, and you go by Sarita Deborah Stevens. So
right.
Is it one does your nonfiction and one does your fiction? Or?
No, just my mood at the time.
Gotcha. I find this – I think I'm going to find this to be extremely interesting.
I hope so.
And very noteworthy. And I'm definitely going to go from cover to cover on this. What made you write this? Was it a...
Well, it was all my teaching. When I'd be teaching and we'd be going over the notes and then I'd be reading my student stuff in class and there wasn't time enough to read the stuff in class and go over their material and give my lecture notes. So I decided to write it out for them, and because they kept on asking me for my lecture notes, and I wrote it out and I decided to do it as a book.
Well, it's actually kind of cool. you know, I've never seen one done this way. So it's, I mean, I've seen a lot of them online and stuff, mm-hmm. you know, but they make it so difficult to go through them. And
yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, you know, I do scripts and books.
Right.
And that's, the workbook is to handle both scripts and books, because basically what you need is a good story.
Mm-hmm.
The formats are different for scripts and books. There's some slight differences in how you handle the wording and page numbers and stuff like that. Present tense, past tense, etc. But basically, you need a good story, a good protagonist, a good antagonist,
right.
and lots of action.
Right.
Lots of action.
I have that in my books.
All right.
I'm
I have
pretty
to,
good bad guys.
I have to say, now, I've been doing this show with you for just about a year. And prior to this, I did a show right in these studios, actually, called Atomic Dog Radio, which had nothing to do with writing. But I was able to interview lots of authors. I've gotten to a point, and I don't think I've really shared this with you yet, Jim, but it's getting to the point now where I'm feeling I want to write.
Good.
I have no idea how to write. I've never done it. I was never very good at it
in school. Put your tush down and start writing.
Is that really what you do? You just
sit down and you start writing. you start with a journal, start with little things that happened to you today, things that come up for you, memories, things that, have happened in your past, and then you start with a what if, what would happen. A lot of my stories are what would happen if this and this happened. Like, for instance, one of my stories is called Match Made in Heaven. It's because my husband and I found out that my mother died on the exact same day as his father. What would happen if these two alpha cockers go to heaven and decide to fix up the two dysfunctional kids? What would happen if?
What if? Yeah. Yeah.
But well, some of the writers, I mean, they're so eloquent in the way they describe what's going on. We had, who was in it? I think our last show, I think maybe it was the one that you weren't here, but what got me was the descriptions were so vivid to me as I read through the material. And I'm terrible. I look
use
at things
all your
and
senses. Use all your senses. You sit down, you imagine the scene in front of you. What are you hearing, seeing, thinking, smelling, feeling, tasting, sensing? And then you write about it from being there and immerse yourself in it. Of course, you can't do thinking when you're writing a script or feelings when you're writing a script, but you can suggest them different ways that they speak or say things and stuff like that.
Well, I see, like, was it James Patterson that seems to write a book every other 3-4 weeks? Many of his books are co-authored.
Yes.
And I was wondering, you mentioned having a good story. Are there people that just know how to come up with these great stories, but they're not good at putting this down in book form?
I'm sure there are, but the thing is that you really have to at least try yourself to do it so that somebody else can help you and guide you, because nobody can tell the story exactly the way you can. It's, you know, it's your passion and what carries it through. You know, I mean, I've had people come and suggest ways I could change my stories. And I, like, one script I had, like, so many notes on, and it was taking it totally a different way. Mm-hmm. And I ended up going back to the original way that I had it, because it's what spoke to me the most.
Is that what you find too, Jim, in your writing?
Yeah, to a degree, yes, I do. I do. But I had a creative writing teacher that she used to hover over everybody, and her big phrase was, tell your own story.
Exactly.
Tell your story. And I wrote a story in creative writing about the Custer Battle, the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Mm-hmm. And it was okay. It was an okay story, but it wasn't mine. And she read that and write in red ink on the front of the page. And the first page of the story, she wrote, write your own story. Mm. So absolutely years later, I wrote Bugles in the Sun, which is, of course, is the 20 days leading up to the battle, but doesn't
how
get there.
How you would have felt being there and seeing.
As a trooper, not as an officer.
Exactly.
So you got the feeling of the troopers there.
Yes, yes, exactly.
And their trepidation.
Well, you know, when I do historical novels, I take events that happened around the time period, and I make up characters that, like one of my books, Tame the Wild Heart, is about James II and William III in Ireland. And my heroine is a niece of Patrick Sarsfield, who was, I mean, imaginary niece. Patrick Sarsfield was one of James II's aide-de-camps, but she falls in love with somebody there. And so I get to tell the story of what's happening through her eyes, you know. So you want to have the historical facts correct, but then you can get the emotion and the feelings through your character.
Yeah, I found that in researching this one particular book, Bugles in the Sun, there was going to be Custer aficionados that were going to know everything that went on from day 20 or day 17 to day 26 or day 25. So I had to be exactly 100% accurate on where these people went and when they went there and how long they were there and who went. And I got it right. And the terrain had to be right. And little tiny things had to be right, because they'll catch you.
Oh, yes, they will.
And they'll bring it up, you know, so it's like when I wrote The Dark Angel, there is a place in The Dark Angel where he retreats to his lair. And it's actually in this place in the Chiricahua Mountains called the Teatro de Diablo. And it's a valley that you have to get to on a ridge, and it's festooned with caves. And it's a real place. It actually exists. And this is where this demon went to go and he self-flagellates to pay his homage to his master. And this is where he goes to rejuvenate, and then he comes back out again.
Right. So, well, you do want to have as things as accurate as possible.
Exactly.
In the book I'm finishing now, The Master's Will, mm-hmm. I have a scene that happens in the Battle of Gettysburg, and I had to do a lot of research for that, even though it only took the scene itself only took about 4 or 5 pages, because I wanted to have it as accurate as possible for my hero, actually, Spencer is an antagonist in the story, but I wanted to have it as accurate as possible for the storyline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's getting it right is a big deal. It's a big part of it. But then also, the story behind it has to be good to keep your attention focused there.
Exactly.
So you will get to the right part.
You have to be the character. The character doesn't always have to be likable.
No.
But you have to have them empathetic enough so that the reader wants to know what happened to them and cares about them.
Right. Right.
Okay, but now when you're taking a story that you've made up, like you say, you have to have a good story. Do you block out your story before you actually attack the writing?
Absolutely.
Or do you just kind of
I outline to death. I do character bios, in-depth character bios, you know, what their nicknames were, what they liked to do as a kid, you know, what their best friends were, their favorite colors, things like that. It doesn't always come out in your writing, but it does in a way because you get to know them. What's their education?
It creates a personality.
Right. I mean, you know, somebody who's a master's degree or has been to Europe, like Will Dawkins in The Master's Will, is going to speak a lot more enunciated than my slaves who mm-hmm. are bought at the slave market, you know.
Interesting. So, now, also, you have fiction and nonfiction, and if you're writing fiction, you can either create your own world where nothing has to be accurate because you've created mm-hmm. everything. You can take a story like Bugles in the Sun, mm-hmm. where you have a story that's happening around something that happened in history.
Mm-hmm.
So those parts have to be accurate. What if you're going to say you want to talk about? Say you wanted to just
like dog training. You mean?
Well, there you go.
Okay.
Exactly.
So the thing is that people have to want to read it. If it's too dry, people are not going to read it.
Sure.
When I'm writing a nonfiction, I take an imaginary scene and I create what would have happened, and I go who, what, where, when, and why. Still, you know, you still
sure.
use those, and you create the emotions and stuff like that. This what would happen if this and this hypothetically had happened,
mm-hmm.
you know. And you get people reading, and they say, "Oh, gee, I know this situation like that. That sounds familiar,"
sure.
you know. And they learn that way. People are not going to learn. A lot of my students who are academics, mm-hmm. lawyers, and stuff like that, write very dry, terse material. And they don't know how to get the emotion across, you know.
Well, they're attorneys, too.
True. But the thing is that they have, you know, or even doctors and stuff like that, you have to get who the personality is. That's one of the reasons why I went to psychiatric nursing, because I like knowing the backstory of why people did what they did.
Okay. And if you take, you bring up nursing, take, you know, so many of the medical shows on television mm-hmm. are wildly popular. You know, we have ER and
Chicago Med.
Chicago Med was good.
And I love that show.
And the current, there's a current one out now. But anyway, there's been a lot of them.
Yes.
It's the story of the characters that keep you involved, even
exactly.
though, because it's, you know, it's gunshot wounds and it's suicides mm-hmm. and it's all the car accidents and all the same thing, but done with different characters.
Exactly. You have to, well, especially if you're doing like TV, they have to want to have the character a goal, and they want to be able to tune back week after week. I want to know what happens to Mackenzie. I want to know what happens to her daughter, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. That's one of the shows that my agent is pitching right now, Nursing the Evidence, based on my book, The Forensic Nurse.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Interesting. You have how many screenplays under your belt?
I don't know, probably about a dozen or so.
Really?
I've only had a couple things produced. A lot of things optioned.
Uh-huh.
But it's a matter of getting the money.
Right. I noticed that you got Hallmark looking at some of your stuff.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And Lifetime.
Yes.
Wow. That's huge.
Did I see something that you wrote? I mean, I don't know if it was optioned or what happened, but there was a Cagney and Lacey. Did I see
I wrote a prequel. I wrote. Uh-huh. I was hired by the studio to write who Cagney and Lacey were before they became cops.
Ah.
I had to watch all the shows and figure out why Cagney didn't go home for her mother's funeral, how Lacey met Harvey, and how they got their first detective badges and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I created that based on what was going on in the storyline, and Dell published it.
Huh, that must have been fun to do.
It was.
Well,
A new direction for you, Jim.
I'm sitting here in awe. I just don't know where to go from here, so I'm going to take a break.
Okay.
We're going to take a short, real short break, and we'll be back with you in about 30 seconds or so, give or take. And we are back in the studio with our guest tonight. And if you were just now joining us...
Where the hell you been?
Where the hell you been? That is exactly right. Serena Stevens is our guest tonight, and she is just a fascinating lady. Screenplays, novels, historical stuff. I mean, just... I want to get into paranormal. What paranormal have you written?
Well, actually, one of my paranormals is called The Unborn Witness, which was a short story, and... It was, and I did a short film as it, and I'm finishing up a feature and a book about it right now. But it's about a young girl in utero, because babies in utero, they say, can experience and hear and remember things that happen 6, 7, 8 months, while they're 9 months, while they're, you know, percolating.
Really?
And so this young baby hears her mother's murder and remembers the voices and decides to go after the killer, who turns out to be her father.
Wow.
And did you think of this?
Yes, I did. It was a what if.
You have a very sick mind. You know that.
But now, how much of that is based on fact as far as the ability for someone to actually recall?
I'm told it is, very much so. Mm-hmm. The research I've read, you know, babies can remember voices, they can remember music, they can remember things that the baby mothers have talked about, especially toward the end of the trimester, of the end of the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Huh. You know, your husband, actually, Hank is in here with us tonight. And we can turn you on if you want to say something, Hank.
Okay. I'm sure you've all heard of Baby Einstein, and the whole premise of that is you play music and everything else, and they say there's definite mathematical abilities that children get when they are exposed to things like that in general.
Mm-hmm. So what, you have to, like, read the times tables to them while you're
while
they're cooking?
Hey, scoot up a little closer to your mic, Hank.
Yeah.
Hank's also a small arms firearms expert, and he was telling a story while we were on the break about CSI. Cyber.
Actually, it was CSI Cyber.
Right, right, right.
And the premise was that a Walther PPK was dropped and went off, and the young man who had it got shot in the chest and killed, which is virtually impossible to happen because of the five safeties built into the weapon itself.
Right.
And I sat there, you know, they could have used any other free-floating firing pin type gun, and it would have worked.
Mm-hmm. But they picked the wrong one.
They picked the wrong one. Having had two Walther PPKs, I know it's virtually impossible to make them go off by accident.
Wow.
So if somebody says, "Well, I shot him by accident," no,
you didn't.
A lot of the producers say, "What's good for the story?"
Right.
But also, you know, when you look in the whole. Like you were talking about evidence bags being plastic rather than paper, and really they should be paper.
Right.
But plastic lends itself well to the production because you can see what's in the bag.
Right.
But how many people really know that? Until you mentioned it, I had no idea.
Oh, well, if you're up on forensics, or if you ask questions, you find out.
Right, but I mean, but in the viewing audience, you know, when you
most
put
people
out a show,
the viewing audience do not know that. That's true.
Yeah, right. Because we're dummies. We believe what's on TV. No, we don't actually. But I mean, you know, we don't have anything to weigh it against. I mean, we saw them taking away evidence at Rockingham and with OJ.
OJ, yeah.
In paper.
Yeah.
In paper,
yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so I figured, well, maybe they just switched to plastic because it's cheaper.
Mm, not really.
It's not reusable. We know that.
Yeah, and we're willing to, most people in the audience are willing to step back from reality to a degree, too.
Well, you have to suspend your reality when you're watching TV, I think.
But I mean talking dinosaurs, things like that.
You are crushing me.
You are. You're killing me.
But even on the medical show, some of the stuff is really not realistic, what they're doing. Or that they could do it so quickly, like DNA. Yeah. I mean, one thing, the DNA quota is what has ruined a lot of cases because people are like, oh, how come there's no DNA? DNA doesn't always appear in a case.
Right. Our producer is coming in, showing himself at the window, telling you to move up closer to
you. He wants you close to the mic there, Hank.
Okay. Also, to carry on.
Bump him up a little
with
bit.
With things like that.
What is it, three? Yeah.
The time frames and things like that it takes to get things done.
Weeks and weeks for
weeks
DNA.
Sometimes for toxicology report.
Yeah.
Things like that are always sped up in TV.
Well, sure. Well, they have an hour to fill. So right. They have to come up with
one
something.
Thing I was recently when Prince passed away and the coroner's report comes out and they say, well, with the toxicology and everything else, we're waiting. And it's been weeks and weeks and they still don't have the final report.
Right.
So it does take a long time, but you can't wait around for 3 weeks on television waiting for that.
Right.
No, because I think
unless you do it as a serial storyline, and then you could refer to it later on.
Oh, sure,
but
you could show that time has actually passed.
Yes,
Sure. I mean, we can always be irreverent too and say, you know, Prince actually died 2 years ago. He just now fell over. Okay, back to Serena Stevens. Enough of my sick sense of humor. We came in tonight and Sam was running downstairs and he goes, the elevator's out again.
Oh, everybody has struggled.
Crap.
Yeah, we're on the fourth floor and it's up the stairs.
It was a walk.
Yeah. It is a hump, especially when you got bad lungs like me and Sarita. Mm. So it's like,
Well, I guess we all have our ups and downs.
Nicely done. Nicely done, Hank.
All right, well, I think we should talk about the master's will.
Okay.
I think
because this is your biggie coming forward.
Coming Civil up, War yes. story.
And why don't you tell us a little thumbnail sketch of the story because it's just reading the little synopsis. It's fascinating.
Well, it is a true story. Basically, I was hired by a descendant of these women who found my agent, and he wrote a basic outline of it, and then I have helped to create it and get it out there. But the storyline is about three African-American women who are purchased pre-Civil War by a lonely South Carolina plantation owner, William Dawkins, a real guy. And he falls in love with these women, not meaning to, has kids with him because he really wants kids. And the Civil War comes. He doesn't know what's going to happen. He decides to leave his property, 90% of his property, to the women and his children because they're his family. And his real family, Spencer Dawkins, who's his nephew, comes back and is infuriated that these women are inheriting. William is murdered by the Ku Klux Klan, and Spencer is infuriated that these women are going to inherit what should have been his because he thought he was going to inherit everything. Because William was a spinster at the time. The equivalent. But anyway, so he puts everything in their way. He doesn't want to file the court papers. He tries to keep the banks from giving them money. And eventually, the women do win their court case. 1878, I believe, is the date that the women finally get a judgment, only with the help of some well-meaning attorneys. But everything is put in their way. So it's a landmark decision for women and blacks.
Something you left out, and I'm only going to say it because it's in the description that you're putting out, that Dawkins spent his time teaching these women to read and write.
Yes, he does.
So they're educated.
But that was against the law at that time, and he got fined for that when the town finds out.
Yeah, it was against the law to have your slaves read and write.
Yeah.
Because you didn't want them smarter than you were. And that usually was the case anyway.
Actually, in South Carolina at the time, I think there were more blacks than there were whites.
Right.
And the whites were afraid of an uprising if the blacks became too knowledgeable.
If they ever learned the laws.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which really doesn't say much for the education level of the whites.
That's true.
Well,
no. Yeah.
I don't think many of the plantation owners really went past sixth or seventh grade.
They probably did. Well, a lot of them, the rich families, they were sent to Europe, you know, for their, you know, education and stuff like that.
The women were.
The men, too.
Yeah.
The men, too, you know.
But I just don't know how much they actually learned.
Oh, well, probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah, gambling and drinking and stuff like that.
Yeah. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
This book is supposed to be coming out this year?
Yes.
When do you expect it to be released?
We don't know exactly. I haven't been given a date yet.
Now sometime after today.
Sometime after today.
You wrote this in conjunction with James Potts.
James Potts is the descendant of the women.
Okay.
And he was the one that found my agent, and she got me together with him.
Wow. That's very cool. Sarita Stevens, James Potts, The Master's Will, based on true events, coming 2016. I like it.
Is James Potts, is he a writer?
Well, he's an attorney.
Yeah.
You need to say more.
Okay. All right. So but that's why he collaborated with
you. Right. No, actually. He actually made a very good effort in writing his book version.
Mm-hmm.
But he was telling a lot and not showing. I mean, right now, in the version that he sent me, I am over 100 pages more than he was. Because he would say, so-and-so did this, and so-and-so did that, and this one happened, and this one happened. In out of two paragraphs, I got 5-6 pages.
Sure.
You know, of seeing, feeling, hearing what happened.
I was going to say what you were talking about earlier, the, you know, who, what, where, when, why, and
the
how.
And experience of the character.
Digging through it, yeah, and expanding on it.
And learning what the personalities were.
And learning the personalities.
If they say, well, this guy shot that guy. Well, why?
Exactly.
You need to know, otherwise it doesn't make any sense.
And why did North, the plantation owner, the neighbor, hate Dawkins? Why was he against him? Because he didn't want the blacks to be, you know, popular. You know, I mean, not popular, to be overcoming him.
Mm-hmm. Did you do a lot of your own research?
I did.
Okay.
I did. I had to.
So you took the basics that James
gave me.
Gave you, and then you did a lot of the research to kind of take the story and bring it to a life, so to speak.
He gave me the copy of the will, of William Dawkins' original will, and some other articles, I believe, and then history from the family, verbal history from the family that came down. And I created the story based on what he gave me.
Were you able to find any other descendants of any of the other people involved in the story?
James has a lot of family descendants that are involved in the story.
Okay, but now he's a direct descendant of one of the three women, correct?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, and then what about like Dawkins himself? Does he have any
descendants? That I don't know.
Oh, okay. I don't mean to put you on the spot. I was just curious about the process of how you
James
get there.
I have to ask James about that. James wrote it up and asked for my help, and I gave it to him willingly.
Maybe you should also explain the difference between inspired by true facts.
Well, yeah, okay.
And based on a true story.
Well, I mean, obviously, we don't have exact dates and times of things that happen. You know, but we can only do what seems natural and what might have led up to it, what the backstory might have been. Mm-hmm. Like, one of my books, Lightning and Fire, is about Deborah the Prophetess, Judges 4 and 5. Well, I mean, I had to have a backstory of why Yael put a tenth into the head of the Canaanite soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because I have her falling in love with Barak, who is Deborah's general.
Oh.
You know, nobody else, I mean, it's not in the Bible. It's not anywhere in there. But I made it up as a bet. Why would she do that?
Sure. So you gave some what-ifs.
Yeah, what-ifs.
And then figure, okay, this is the direction I think it might have gone.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, that's very interesting. There was, Jim, you just mentioned about, based on true facts. And I was listening to NPR just the other day, and they were discussing a story that was based on true facts. But that could be that you have this whole story, and in the story, this woman got into a car. Well, in reality, she did get into the car. Uh-huh. So the story's based on true facts.
Uh-huh.
But that's the only part of it that they know.
The difference between inspired by and based on, and, you know, as told to and things like that, there's different variations of telling a story from true facts.
Yeah, I've always found that inspired by gives you more leeway to write a story that you want to tell.
Right.
And based on, you kind of have to stick to the facts.
You have to stick to the facts more carefully than you would otherwise.
Right. So, I mean, I like Bugles and the Sun was based on the writings of troopers who were there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's where the title came from, was from William Varnum.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because he found all the bugles when he walked the battlefields glistening in the sun.
That. Yeah.
So that's where the name of the
Okay, now I want to go a different direction.
Okay.
Screenwriting.
Yes. Ah.
Okay, this is really different.
Well, it's not different in that it is different. You have to have a good story, basically, no matter what.
Sure.
A good protagonist, a good antagonist, mm-hmm. You know, and action, something that engages you, especially from the very beginning. Actually, I teach a course with Women Helping Women, the Sandra Lord's group, and you can find out about that at HollywoodNetworkingBreakfast.org. Mm-hmm. And my next class is called About the First 10 Pages, how important that is, how crucial that is. And that's important for books as well as for scripts, but even more so for scripts.
You got to reach out and grab somebody.
Yes.
In fact, you know, going back to Against Her Will, mm-hmm. that the first chapter is it does
the
grab
first
you.
Paragraph the first grabs you.
Oh, yeah. Because you know something is not kosher.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And when, you know, I want people to read this. It was a great book. I really enjoyed it. But it grabbed a hold of me, and I thought, okay, what's going on? And then suddenly you realize, and in fact, actually, after you read the story, that part about what happened, can mm-hmm. I say what?
Yeah.
Okay, so the guy is on drugs, and he's up on the roof of the mental hospital, mm-hmm. and in his mind, he thinks he can just jump over the fence and land on his feet, where in reality, it was probably several stories, and he jumped and he died.
Right.
But you don't realize that he's not seeing things straight until after he does the jump. And when he jumps, you stop it right there, and then you go into the next chapter, mm-hmm. and the people are talking about what's going on.
Right.
But you don't know if he's dead. You don't know what happened.
Actually, you don't even really understand that it really happened.
You want to be able to have, you know, the reader say, I got to get to the next chapter. I got to read. Even though it's 2 a.m. in the morning, I got the next chapter.
Right. And that's how it was with me when I read it. But was all that blocked out ahead of time?
Yes.
Like you knew exactly how you were going to present
that. Pretty much so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I, you know, there's a lot of people don't like to outline. They want to write from what, see their pants, just let it flow. But when you do that, you get mixed up in the middle. You forget things. You don't know where you're going. Mm-hmm. And this, in fact, by outlining, I can do several books at once because I can have be writing the outline for one, chapters on another, a script on another, and I know where I'm going with each section.
I knew that had to be the case because I figured otherwise you never sleep. I mean, what else, you know? How much time do you spend a day writing?
Well, my daughter says I'm on the computer 24/7, uh-huh. but that isn't the case. But sometimes I say I'm coming into the bedroom at 10 o'clock, 11:30 I come in, and my husband says, who is this woman?
What are you doing in my bedroom?
Exactly.
You ever had writer's block?
Not really. No. If I have writer's block, you would call writer's block, I go back and ask, who are the characters, what do they want, what do they need, and who is against them? And if I really have writer's block, I take a walk, take a bath, do something like that, or I go to another story. And sometimes when I'm on another story, I'll think, oh, I can do this and this with the story.
Oh. Do you normally have several stories going, several books at one time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
So how many books, screenplays, if you were to total everything, how many have you got? I know your press sheet says over 40, right?
Yeah.
It says over 40.
At least.
And how many do you currently have in process?
In process, I currently have 4 in process right now.
4.
I have 1.
Okay. But, you know, everybody's process is different.
Well, yeah. Plus, I work a 50-hour week. And
Yes.
And
when I was working full-time, it was very difficult.
Yeah.
However, I would, and when I lived in Chicago, I would, you know, ride on the bus going to work. I wouldn't have lunch with my friends. I would gobble down my lunch, and the rest of the 20 minutes, I would be writing. People want to go out for drinks. I'm saying, no, I've got to go home and write. You know, you have to decide what's your priority.
Right. You know, I like I said, I work a 50-hour week. I prepare for this show. It takes a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then I try to get at least 2,500 words or more every 3 or 4 days. And it's putting it all together is hard. And then, you know, I'm going to get home and Jerry's critiquing the show as we're speaking right
okay.
now.
Okay. Sure.
But, you know, one thing I will say, if someone was going to ask me about you, I'd say you are passionate and driven.
Oh, I definitely am.
Oh, phenomenal.
I would always have been.
I know, but you have the energy of a teenager.
Oh, thank you.
No, you do. I mean, I'm very impressed.
Me too.
I love this.
She's like, I'm in awe.
Well, it's a matter of persistence and knowing what you want.
Mm-hmm.
when I was writing that book, Lightning and Fire, the very first version of it, my first husband gave it to a literary writer friend of his father's who said, honey, go home and do your homework, go do your housework. And I went home and I cried for a couple of days and I said, fuck you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, oh, for sure.
I am going to do this no matter what. And actually, so that was one of my first seven that doesn't get published, and it took me almost 15 years later to finally finish it the way I wanted to be, come out and finish it properly.
And we have now had a first on the writer's block. Oh, the first utterance of the F word.
The F bomb, yes. That's okay. That's all right. Nobody's going to come in.
Nobody's going to say a word. Yeah. Nobody's
I've got the door locked.
Okay.
Hey, look, in the time we have left, we're running short of time. Can you give our listeners your information, where to contact you, how to get in touch with you?
Sure.
Some of the titles of your books, where they can find them.
Well, Amazon.com, of course.
Okay.
And my website is www.saritastevens.com.
Okay.
They can all look me up on IMBD as well.
Okay.
Barnes and Noble.
My email is sstevenstarlow@gmail.com.
Okay.
I'm happy to help people. I do a lot of mentoring and assisting people with their material. And as a forensic nurse, I will sometimes go over people's medical or investigative scenes in their stories for them.
One thing I want to ask you, though, can you help me? I'm hearing voices.
Yes.
Can you help me?
Sure. No. Trazic, no. Haldol.
Oh, Haldol. Thorazine. You know, I used to go down by the Western State Hospital in Tacoma all the time, and that's where all the veterans were, the ones that were kind of like nuts, and they would have the Thorazine full of Thorazine, and they would do what we would call the Thorazine shuffle.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure you guys called it the same thing.
But, you know, I think being persistent and knowing what you want to do is the most important thing.
Oh, I'm absolutely certain of that.
It's not a failure. It's another try.
If there is any book that I would recommend tonight from Sarita Stevens, I certainly would recommend Against Her Will.
Thank you.
Wonderful read. Russ and I both read it. I would be just horribly interested in the Book of Poisons.
Yes.
Because I've been thinking about using poison, and I want to get the right one. So, Sarita, you probably sold that book to me.
Mm-hmm.
Forensic Nurse, The Ultimate Writer's Workbook is a must for any writer.
Thank you.
Screenplays or novels or biographies or whatever you want to write. I'm going to go through this thing and make my notes, and I'm just
you're going to have to let me borrow it.
Thank you so much for that. That's a great gift.
You're welcome.
And it's been a wonderful, wonderful treat having you on the show, and it's just been great talking with you. And we thank you so much for spending your time with us this evening.
Thank you, guys. I enjoyed it.
And I'm sorry that you had to crawl up four flights of stairs.
It is easier going down.
I wasn't looking forward to it either. So, Russ, good to see you, my friend.
It's good to be seen. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure having you on board.
I love doing this. And this has been, I have to say, Sarita, this has been educational for me.
Oh,
again, I'm inspired by your passion and energy for this.
Truly, truly. And once again, if any book you got to read, Against Her Will, it's a must read. Isn't that what the name of it?
Yeah, Against Her Will.
Against Her Will.
Yeah.
Against Her Will. Bobby Jean, of course, tonight she has her concert series. And
Jim, who again is she having at her concert series?
I do not know. I'm somewhat remiss in my informational tracks here, so I don't know. But we wish her the best, wherever she may be. Usually she tries to call in, but she didn't tonight, so she has the number. Okay, that's about it for us tonight. We thank you for listening. Thank you for showing up and being with us on the Writer's Block. And if there's anything at all we can do for you, of course, you can always get a hold of Ms. Stevens here at, what is it, saritawriter@yahoo.com?
No, it's, that one doesn't work so much anymore. sswriter400@gmail.com.
Okay. And then if you have any questions, you can call her directly. You can get a hold of me, JimChristina@yahoo.com. You can get a hold of the Writer's Block. You can get a hold of Bobby Jean at BobbyJeanBell@gmail.com. And don't bother calling Russ.
No. I won't answer anyway.
And we want to thank you again for joining us. Good night, and have yourselves a pleasant week.